This is Spectrum.
Alternative Myth, Homeopathy, Secret Society, Hypnosis, The Paranormal, Alternative Energy, UFO Abduction, The Weird, The Wild, and The Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Unless, of course, you have wisdom, in which case you don't need any more information. Mike Baer is a New York Times bestselling author, screenwriter, and lecturer. A self-described born-again conspiracy theorist, Mike's first book, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, co-authored with Richard C. Hoagland, was a New York Times bestseller in 2007. His essay, The Occult History of NASA, appears in Secret and Suppressed 2. Mike has made numerous public appearances lecturing on the subjects of space science, NASA, physics, and the link between science and spirit, and has been a featured guest on radio programs like Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. He began his writing career after spending more than 25 years as a card-carrying member of the military-industrial complex, where he worked for a wide variety of aerospace companies as an engineering consultant and designer. In 2010, Mike returns with The Choice, a new book in which he describes the unified field theory of physics and metaphysics. He promises that The Choice will peel back the layers of mystery around the Mayan calendar, 2012, and the future we can expect if we don't heed nature's warning signs. His first novel, Lightbringer, is currently being shipped to publishers. In addition, a documentary film based on The Choice is currently in production, and a spec script based on Lightbringer is currently being adapted for the big screen. Hello, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. Nice to be with you.
Oh, right. I remember. I'm supposed to call you Mike.
Yeah, that's right. We agreed on that, didn't we?
Yeah, we agreed on that.
Yeah.
Okay, Mike. The way I like to start is I like to get a little bit of history. We've given your bio, but I like to get a little bit deeper into that and ask you, you've written a book called The Choice, and you co-wrote a book called Dark Mission with Richard Hoagland. Everybody knows who Richard Hoagland is, I would hope, by now, after all the years in Art Bell and the Coast to Coast show with George Norrie. But I want to know what dots connected you to where you are in your life right now. Was there was there a specific event, or was it just sort of a series of events of in your life that led to you where you are now?
Yeah, it was really like that. It was a series of events that were, you know, as you look back on it, it was almost inevitable. You know, I've always been interested in, you know, UFOs, the extraterrestrials, the paranormal, things like that. And as I got into my, I guess, early 30s, I started wanting to do something, you know, to be involved in that. And one of the things that I'd always been curious about was this, the face on Mars. I'd remembered this picture from the 1970s when Viking was in orbit around the planet Mars, and there was this thing that looked like a human face on the, you know, on the surface of the planet. And I remembered that NASA had poo-pooed the whole thing and said it was just a trick of light and shadow. And then, you know, one day I was at a, I guess it was a trading card show back, you know, sports cards with my stepson. And there was these UFO cards, and one of them, and it was the Face on Mars card. This is about 1990.
Okay.
And along the way, you know, I'm working a day job as an engineer and fairly comfortable doing that. And I remembered I had met somebody there named Fran Johnston and worked with her for a while. Anyway, to make the story a little bit shorter, as time went by, a guy named Ken Johnston Jr. started working with Richard C. Hoagland. And what he was working with Richard on was he had had a bunch of original first-generation handheld Apollo photographs from all the missions to the moon. In other words, the pictures the astronauts took with their cameras on the surface of the moon. And he had given those to Richard to study, and Richard had found some very interesting things on it and on these pictures. And along about the same time, I got put on a night shift, which I wasn't really very happy about. So I'm driving home late at night, and guess what's on the air? Well, the old Art Bell show.
Right.
Back when it was the Art Bell show, before it was even Coast to Coast AM. And there's this guy on there all the time, blabbing and talking, Richard C. Hoagland. I hope he doesn't listen to this. Going on and on and on. But I'm really appreciating the depth of detail that he's giving. And I'm saying, this guy really sounds really smart. And then I remember one time walking past a room on my lunch hour, a little office room, and a bunch of my coworkers are in there watching something on TV, and I poke my head in, and there's this guy, Richard C. Hoagland, on there talking about The Face on Mars. And so there's all these little things that kept kind of pushing me to this.
Mm-hmm.
And then lo and behold, when Richard put up his website, enterprisemission.com, when he put it up at first, I was on the old bulletin board there, and I was responding to some stuff, and Ken Johnson comes in and he says, "Hey, my wife Fran thinks she remembers you from Boeing a few years ago. You know, do you remember Fran?" And I said, "Well, yeah, of course I do." So through Ken, I got connected to Richard. And then, you know, Richard and I started conversing from time to time on the phone, and I got more and more interested in what he was doing, and at that time it was mostly moon stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, around 1998, when Mars Global Surveyor was finally in orbit around Mars and was about to take the first picture of the face on Mars that had been taken in 20 or 30 years.
Which was going to be the new definitive picture, right?
Yeah, and it didn't quite work out that way, as we all know, the old cat box photo of the face on Mars.
Yeah.
But I called Richard up, you know, and I said, "Hey, you know, would you like an article for your website on image enhancement?" And he said, "Sure." So I wrote it up. And he really liked it. He liked my writing, so I wrote him another article, and then I wrote him a couple more. And the next thing you know, he and I are working together on articles. I'm, you know, writing some of my own solo, and they're all going up on the Enterprise Mission website. And it just kind of, you know, took off from there. We'd been working together about 6 or 7 years, and at one point I said, you know, why don't we take all these articles and put them together in a book, because what happens is, you know, we have all the context in our heads, right? And we're reminding people of things that happened 2 or 3 years ago that NASA said that are now in complete conflict with what they're saying today. And I said, you know, it would really help maybe if we had a book where we put everything in a kind of a linear chronological order and recap the history of all this stuff, even though Richard had already had Monuments of Mars out.
Right,
and he said, "Yeah, it sounds like a great idea," and that was Dark Mission, and it took me and him about 4 years to write, and that was primarily because at the very beginning of it, I moved out to LA and got a little bit distracted by Los Angeles,
the bright lights,
and the pretty girls and all that stuff. But eventually, it came out right at the perfect time in 2007. And it was real successful, New York Times bestseller. And then some things shifted in my life. I started to get more serious about certain things. I got, you know, divorced. I was shifting around jobs, but I was living in L.A. And in the fall of 2009, I got kind of involved with somebody I really cared about. Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Didn't you get a call on November 9th on 2009?
Well, I got a call.
And
the wake-up call, it was a wake-up call from the universe, you know, or from God or whatever you want to say. And it was an extraordinary spiritual experience that I shared with this other person. And it was really eye-opening. And at that time, I had been thinking a lot about 2012 and the Mayan thing. And Richard and I had been talking about Dark Mission 2 and were we going to put some of that stuff into Dark Mission 2 and connecting the physics.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fascinating to me because later on, Sean David Morton, a friend of mine, pointed out to me that night, that very evening, was the exact shift in what is Carl Johan Kalman's version of how to interpret the Mayan calendar from the sixth day to the sixth night of the galactic underworld of the Mayan calendar. It's a complicated thing. We can get into it later if you want.
Well, Kalman said that was when everybody was going to
wake
on.
Yeah. Exactly. Turn on and wake up. And it happened to me, at literally exactly midnight, timing-wise. It literally was 100%. Absolutely in line with what Kalman said, and I said to myself, holy crap, this Mayan calendar stuff is real, and I need to do something about this. So because Richard and I couldn't exactly agree on the direction we wanted to take with Dark Mission 2, I just kind of decided to go off and write what I felt compelled to write, which was my new book, The Choice, which has been out now for a couple months from New Page Books. And I'm really happy with how it came out, and I really said what I needed to say. So that's how I ended up here talking to you on the radio.
So yeah, I knew there was a story there.
It's a long story, but I think it's worth the trip.
It's a good story. It's a good story. But you have been interested in these fields for several decades.
Oh yeah, forever. You know, I can remember being a little kid, 4, 5, 6 years old, watching the Gemini launches. I don't remember Mercury because I was just little, but watching these missions and just having a lot of doubts and having a lot of thoughts cross my head, you know, through my head. I remember asking my dad, you know, if we've got color TV, how come they can't give us color TV pictures from the moon, you know, and how come it doesn't look very good? And there were just, I could just felt like there were things that they weren't telling us, like there were secrets that they were keeping and right, things that didn't add up. And that, you know, led me to be interested in UFOs and aliens and extraterrestrials because I was starting to ask the questions, well, what could they be covering up? Right. And eventually, you know, I found Richard and I kind of concluded a very bizarre sort of Egyptian ritual process that they were going through. But, you know, it really, from the time that I was conscious, I was interested in this stuff.
Right. Yeah, me too. I remember being like 13, when I wasn't reading Aristotle Ethics, I was reading like stories about the Loch Ness Monster.
Yeah.
I was reading books. Yeah, Bigfoot, absolutely. UFOs, anything weird, I was reading it. And that and science fiction. So if you mix science fiction with that stuff, your mind can go all kinds of places.
You know, I remember a great magazine from that time called Saga or Saga, S-A-G-A. And it had two things in it. It had UFO stories and UFO alien paranormal stories, and it had almost naked girls in it. That was the greatest magazine ever.
The underwear section of the Sears catalog.
Yeah, it was a strange magazine. I'll have to look it up online, but it was the weirdest combination. But it was definitely aimed at boys who were curious about two different, you know, the two greatest mysteries of life.
Weird stuff and lingerie, yeah.
Weird stuff and lingerie.
Exactly. Yeah, I remember getting into, reading all the books I could get my hands on of parapsychology and psychokinesis, and that got me into doing research and our remote viewing and testing people on remote viewing and testing hundreds of people on remote viewing, getting the information from SRI, you know, calling them on a weekly basis.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
My phone bill was like insane, right? Back in my early teens.
You know, Scott, it's really funny because everybody who ends up working in this field, it's like that for them. It's from the time they are little, they just have this fascination and almost compulsion to investigate this stuff. I can't remember a time I wasn't interested in these things. I know, again, my friend Sean David Morton, he tells stories. I don't think he can remember a time when he wasn't interested in this stuff. And the same thing with you. So it's just, it's almost like we were born to do this work and to flip over these rocks and see what's underneath them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it wasn't enough just to read about it. It became not enough just to read about it. I had to get involved.
Exactly.
I had to, like, call Stanford Research Institute and say, okay, so tell me all about your protocols and how do you do that? And, mm-hmm. and then talk to when the crop circles first came out, wow, that was a whole adventure right there.
Yeah.
Getting into the crop circles and doing research study on near-death experience and getting letters from people all over the world reporting their near-death experience, which was supposed to be just like a two-month thing. I figured, we can wrap this whole mystery up in 2 months. What little did I know?
Yeah.
You can't really wrap these mysteries up.
I'm sure you never do. Yeah, you just never do, you know.
Because there's always more. There's always more. And the other thing I've found, personally, is you got to be really careful about running a program. The scientific community can get very, very much into the headspace of creating, looking at something open-minded, then creating some theories and then writing about those theories. And once they write about the theories, they become identified with the theories. They become locked into those theories.
Right.
And then that's when the shutters close.
Right.
It's no more of that childlike, I want to know energy.
Yeah. You've decided what it is, and that's kind of what it has to be.
Yeah. Yeah, you're done at that point.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then so, you know, if you ask simple questions like, well, why is it that the electrons in the nucleus don't just fly apart?
Yeah.
Well, see, there's these things called gluons.
No, it's torsion, actually, is what it is. But
no, I know, but gluons is just it's just another answer that says we don't know what this is, so we're going to give it the word gluon.
Right. There must be something called a gluon that glues everything together.
Oh, great. Can you sell me a picture of a gluon? Well, no, we can't really do that. But there's been research done in Russia on torsion fields for, like, decades.
Right, exactly.
Right, so
exactly. But if you go to Wikipedia, that's all just a scam and a fraud.
Yeah, I mean, you have to get really obscure books, like I've mentioned on the show before, called Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah,
it's about Karyov's work and torsion fields.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I probably said his name wrong, but
well, there's Nikolai Kozyrev is who I write about in The Choice.
Kozyrev, that's the
Kozyrev
guy. His work is in the book called Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain. If you can get it, it's a difficult book to track down.
Right, right. But, I mean, a lot of stuff now is on the internet, and you might even have some luck finding it now on the web, because I know Google is putting a lot of obscure books on the web for you to read. So it's kind of a nice, Google has its downside, but it also has an upside, and that's one of the things that's it's kind of an upside, I think.
Well, let's talk about that, because one of the areas you've been, if you're connected to Richard Hoagland, then you've probably written about hyperdimensional physics.
Yeah, The Choice is really primarily what I'm arguing in The Choice is that this hyperdimensional physics theory that Richard has, primarily he and Errol Torin, mm-hmm. is the one that explains pretty much everything about how the universe really works, and it's all connected to what's happening to us consciously during this huge transition we're going to go through and that we are going through, that we're kind of associating with the Mayan calendar and with 2012. So,
okay. Let's connect the Mayan calendar and hyperdimensional physics.
Well, the important thing that certain people don't appreciate, and this was something that again compelled me to write The Choice, is that, like Dr. Kalaman, he's interpreted what the Mayans said pretty close to correctly. I think there's a few places that he's in error, but for the most part, I think he's really figured it out. But he doesn't understand what's driving it and what's driving all this stuff, this shift in consciousness, this revolution that we're going through and that we're going to continue to go through for quite a while, is the physics, which is in fact driven by the planets themselves in this solar system. What hyperdimensional physics essentially says is that you can pull energy from someplace higher, some hyperspace, by just doing one thing, spinning stuff. All you have to do is make things spin, and you will gate energy from a higher dimension. That's essentially the core of the theory. And there's all sorts of experiments and things that back that up. So what then that means in addition is that if you look at the planets themselves, which have most of what's called the angular momentum, the bulk angular momentum in the solar system, what it essentially means is that the planets are driving everything, not the sun. You know, conventional physics looks at the sun and says everything is driven by the sun because it has the most gravity and the most mass and therefore the most energy.
Mm-hmm.
In the hyperdimensional concept, no, it's the planets that have the most spin energy, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, the so-called gas giants, that are the most important. Right. And through this spin energy, they are sort of creating the energetic field in which the Earth exists, in which all the other planets exist, in which life is able to exist. So, now,
can you expand that? Like, can you expand just the planets to the solar system, to the solar system in the spiral arm spinning,
right,
to the center
right.
of the galaxy? That's
right. Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is,
this
everything
is macroscopic and microscopic, right?
Right, right. Everything in this universe is constantly in motion. It is constantly spinning. It is constantly rotating. In fact, you know, one of the things I talk about in the choice that I really get into, not in great super technical depth, but just deep enough to sort of make my argument, is that I think what time actually is this spiraling kind of left to right, spiraling physical forward movement. That's time. And I think that if the universe ever stopped moving forward, we would all cease to exist. It's the motion itself of everything that is essentially what time is. And it's not the easiest concept to explain because we tend to think of time as a measure of duration. Whereas, in fact, what it really is it's a forward movement through whatever the heck this universe really is. So at the biggest level, what we're talking about is that everything must rotate. And if it doesn't rotate, it ceases to be. And some things rotate faster than others and have more mass and therefore have more hyperdimensional energetic influence. So I guess what you would also say is then every system is connected, because what you've got is you've got, let's start with the Earth. The Earth is spinning on its own axis. It is also rotating or spinning around the Sun. The Sun is spinning around perhaps other stars, but certainly it is orbiting or spinning or rotating around the center of the galaxy. The galaxy is rotating, spinning around other galaxies. So it's basically everything is a connected system. But what most dramatically affects us physically, consciously, emotionally here on the planet Earth is our own set of 8 or 9 planets, however you want to call them, and the Sun. And that is what's really driving all the cultural changes that we're going to experience and we've had been experiencing in the last few years. So, I don't know. Did I explain it?
No, yeah, you did.
Really well?
That's good. You brought in the planets and the energy. So this, in a way, sort of validates astrology.
Actually, I think you can absolutely confirm astrology, because here's a really interesting thing. One of the stories I talk about in The Choice is about the work of John Nelson for RCA. And he was an engineer that was hired by RCA in the 1950s. And I asked him to figure out why at certain times of the year shortwave radio signals were crystal clear and other times they were all messed up. And what he found was, okay, there's a connection between sunspot activity, solar storms, and the quality of the shortwave radio signals. But what he also found was that it was the positions of the planets, the so-called configurations in their orbits around the Sun, which were causing these these periods of excitability or these periods of quiet on the Sun itself. And not only did he find that the biggest planets, the planets with the most spin energy, which again are Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, were the most influential planets, he also found that when they were in positions that corresponded to what are called aspects in astrology, positive or negative aspects, that they had a positive or negative effect. It directly correlated with astrology. As an example, something called a trine is considered a positive aspect. That's where you've got, let's say, 3 planets. Let's say it's Saturn, Jupiter, and Uranus in essentially a triangle spread out about 120 degrees from each other with the Sun at the center. That's considered a positive aspect. When a configuration like that took place, the Sun was very quiet and the shortwave radio signals were very good. Now, if 2 or 3 planets that were very influential were square to each other, in other words, at 90 degrees around this circle, it's considered a negative aspect. And guess what? The Sun would get very excited. It would be spewing out all kinds of solar storms, and the shortwave radio signals would go to heck. Oppositions are another example. If you've got, let's say, Saturn and Jupiter on opposite sides of the Sun, directly across from each other with the Sun kind of in the middle, the Sun gets very active, the magnetic storms increase, and the radio signals went crazy. So not only did the planets affect this physical radio wave signal, this light energy, this energy, but they also affected it exactly according to the way astrologers had always interpreted the positions of the planets. The positive aspects were positive, the negative aspects were negative. And that right there in of itself is, to me, absolute confirmation that astrology is real. And so then as I was looking at what I was, you know, predicting was going to happen during this 2012 period, I definitely took the traditional astrology into account, because I think these guys somehow, through, you know, from ancient times, had it all figured out.
Right. They, so that, that the work of the Mayans, and previous to them, the Olmecs.
Yeah.
Of course. A lot of the previous stuff the Mayans were, a lot of the stuff the Mayans were talking about previously, the Olmecs were talking about. And the Aztecs and the I Ching and all of these other connections were mentioning is the fact that they understood the celestial information.
Yeah.
Extremely well.
Yeah, and so the planets, you know, it wasn't, people like think to themselves, well, what can difference can the positions of the planets make? Gravity is very, very minimal, a very minimal influence, and magnetism is very minimal. But what we just talked about a little earlier, torsion, is intense, you know, it's a huge influence on our physical reality and our mental reality and our emotional reality. So these ancient cultures either knew it because they were told by some higher civilization that this stuff was important, or they just intuitively knew it in their hearts that when the planets were in certain positions, you know, on these this repeating 26,000 year processionary cycle we go around, that, you know, things were going to happen and things were going to change. And what they're saying is that this period in time is going to change. We're going to, our culture is going to change really, really dramatically. And, you know, of course, we see that happening around us right now. But yeah, basically, the ancient cultures, they all understood this, and, you know, we, in our way of knowing through only through our minds as opposed to also using our hearts, we just kind of forgot this stuff.
Right, and the previous cultures also talked about previous ages, with the Mayans talking about we're in the fourth age now.
Right.
If this age doesn't, you know, they float up just to the edge, and they almost make it over the edge. But they don't quite make it consciously, or events happen that end up wiping out that civilization. So if we make it, we'll, you know, the fourth civilization will be done. But if we don't make it, then we go on to the fifth civilization.
Well, the important thing to remember, and this is why I called the book The Choice, is that I realized as I got through this and I looked at the astrology and I looked at the ancient, you know, cultures, the Hindus, the Vedas, the Mayans, the Hopi, even the Egyptians, what they were all talking about that people didn't really get, at least none of the 2012 people got, was that this was all up to us, that this was a spiritual choice that we make at each time we come to this nexus. You know, I think what happens is, and Richard and I had speculated looking at the ruins on the moon and the ruins on Mars, that a lot of this stuff is not extraterrestrial, it's human, but that the human race has risen to great heights before and then come crashing down. And you find that this is all confirmed in these ancient so-called myths and legends of these various ancient cultures. And so, you know, what I'm trying to get across to people is that the apocalypse is not something that just happens to you. It's something that you get to actively participate in and actively make a choice.
Right.
And
because
so
the word apocalypse means the lifting of the veil.
It means to lift the veil and the change and to reveal that which has been hidden. And what that does is that, I think, creates the conflict. And, you know, I if you look at the way the Hopi interpreted the previous worlds, it appears that I think we got to this point, this really dramatic high point in our civilizations, and spiritually anyway, energetically, we probably looked around and said, you know, this really isn't working very well, we're very materialistic, we're not, let's wipe the slate clean and start over. And so that's why there's so many different theories about what's going to happen in 2012, is because they're all possible. We could have a solar flare, we could have, you know, a pole shift, we could
So that answers my question of whether it's going to be, you know, doom and gloom, or whether it's going to be we're all joining hands singing Kumbaya, and there will be kittens.
And what I'm trying to get across to people is it's up to us, and what we have to do is spend these next couple years, because I think this period goes beyond December 21st, 2012, all the way up to maybe 2023, where we're voting, essentially. And we have to make our choice. Do we want to continue with this world we've created? and build on what we have and make it better, or do we want to wipe the slate clean and start over again? So what's going to happen is up to us. It's our choice.
And that's why you wrote The Choice.
The Choice, exactly. Right.
Right. So first you have the secret.
Yeah.
And then you have the choice.
The choice, yeah. Okay. Sorry.
I think the secret was a little bit I think it's great because it woke up a whole bunch of people who but it maybe it woke them up like, I want a brand new car. I want a bigger house. I want 12 credit cards instead of two. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like to say in my lectures, the secret is great if all you want out of life is, is fast car, a big house, and a hot girlfriend. And not that there's anything wrong with those things.
I was going to say,
what I'm trying to get across, the choice is more powerful than attraction. Attraction is attracting things to yourself selfishly. Choice, I try to get people to, and I talk about this in the book, is to think about what do you want, not just for yourself, but for your friends, your family, your community, your city, your country, your planet. What do you want? What kind of a world do you want to live in? And try to visualize that in your meditations and your prayers, and then that's what we will end up creating. And think less selfishly and just more about, about everybody else rather than just yourself.
Yeah, well,
which is hard to do.
We're a collective. I get that. It is hard to do. We are a collective, and what we want, maybe if we have a big family, a wife and three kids, and all of this stuff going on in our life, maybe what's best for us isn't best for our family unit. Maybe what's best for our family unit isn't what's best for the community.
Yeah, yeah. Other thing too. Sorry. The other thing about the secret that really torques me off is that I think, in my studies personally, and people can agree with me or not agree with me about this, I think that everybody comes into life with a soul purpose and a life path, okay? And what I mean by those is that you have lessons that you came here to learn in this particular incarnation or this particular rebirth. And the life path is how you chose to learn those lessons, or how your guides have chosen for you to learn your lessons, like the Adjustment Bureau. There's a path you're set to follow. And what the secret teaches you is that anybody can have anything they want. Anybody can be rich. Anybody can be famous. Anybody can be, anything they want to be. And that's not true. I, in some lifetimes, you come into life, your life, to be a ditch digger. Sometimes people come into a life where they want to be the bricklayer, not the architect. And so what I try to get across is that the key to happiness, at least, and to making this spiritual vote work and this planet to become harmonious, which is hopefully ultimately going to save us from all the 2012 doom and gloom stuff, is to figure out, is not to necessarily have ambitions to be something that you're not, but to figure out what you're supposed to be.
Yeah,
what are you supposed to be? And
yeah,
then
I
be
agree.
That. And then that in itself will be a vote.
Yeah. Instead of meditating on a Porsche, maybe you should meditate on, okay, there's things that I need to be doing.
Right.
What should I be doing? What are these things? What is this round peg going to do in a square hole when it should be in a round hole?
Right.
I need
to
find my round hole. And yes, I might like to be on a beach in Cancun on Monday, but I probably should go to work.
Yeah, exactly. And I do frequently meditate on a Porsche, and I'm going to try to manifest that. But look, there's certain in other words, I know enough. I think about myself at this point to know that a certain level of attention is something that it's okay for me in this life path. I mean, that's why I'm sitting here being interviewed by you. That's why I write books and why they've been published, is because that's okay. Not everybody has that. And the secret, I think, it convinces everybody that they can be a movie star. And and not everybody can, and not everybody should even try to be that. They should try to be who they really are.
Yeah, well, the thing is that there's a lot of people that can swim, and there's some people that can't swim.
Yeah,
there's a lot of people that can swim to stay afloat for a little while, and they'll eventually drown. There's people that can stay afloat for a long time. There's people that can swim so well that they can join competitions, and there's people at the very small amount that can win Olympic gold medals Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody can win Olympic gold medals.
Right.
Well, I'm talking about reality, and reality is there's a small percentage of people that can win gold medals, just as if you test 200 people for remote viewing, you're going to get two people who are 100% bang on.
Right.
Like you just, they just nail it every single time. And then you're going to have a scale of people going all the way down to people can't imagine. And, you know, they couldn't imagine an apple to save their life. They couldn't remote view their own arse without a mirror.
Yeah, I think I'm one of them. I'm pretty unpsychic. I'm not very psychic at all. I just notice things when they happen. Yeah.
There are scales of everything. So what you need to do is find out where your gold medals are in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Because you do have, everybody has abilities that fit. And it's an interesting thing that I've done this for a couple years now. I ask people just this question. What would you do if money didn't exist? A lot of times what I get is, what do you mean? I work hard. I deserve to get paid for what I do. And I say, okay, if you can't roll that into your consciousness of a world without money, then how about if I were to give you $1 billion, what would you do?
Right.
And then they go, oh, okay, because now I've not broken their internal outlook on the planet.
Their frame of reference. Yeah,
their frame of reference, right.
Exactly.
So, but some other people can go, okay, no money in the world, what would I do? And the number one answer has mostly been, I don't know. I guarantee you, I've done this for 2 years now. The number one answer is, I don't know. And then you got other people who say stuff, well, I'd hang out on a beach and drink margaritas and, you know, girls in skirts would deliver them to me. And which is cool too, you know, hey.
Yeah.
But I have other people that say, well, I've always wanted to write a book, I would write a book. I've always wanted to paint, I would paint. You know what? Right. I do music as a hobby, but if there was no money, I would do music every day.
Right. Right.
You know, what they do is they, what Joseph Campbell talked about in Follow Your Bliss, they would follow their bliss. And I find it very interesting that everybody has that innate thing that they should be doing.
Right.
But one of the things is they come up with reasons why.
And I mean, the thing is like, you know, let's say it's writing, and that's what I feel called to do. And I guess I'm lucky enough that I get to have some success from that. Now, you know, I want more, but I'm lucky enough. Maybe not everybody is going to necessarily be hugely successful as a writer, but there are people out there that do get books published, and they, you know, they do write for a living, or they do write, you know, on the side from their day jobs, and that's perfectly okay. The important thing is to just be doing what feels like your, you know, I hate to say your heart's desire, but basically that's what it is. And so few of us actually do that. There are some people that come into this life and their main thing is to get married and have kids and raise a big family. More power to them. I would go crazy. And by the way, if the girls on the beach would be in bikinis, not skirts. But
okay. I was thinking of grass skirts.
Variation. Yeah, I'd rather have bikinis.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Okay, so when you wrote The Choice, you said it was because of this awakening you had, and we talked about the hyperdimensional physics, and I wanted to ask you a question. How do airplanes fly?
Nobody knows, actually. There is a this is interesting because there's a theory, which is that you design an airfoil to a certain shape, and if you push a vehicle fast enough down a runway, that the difference in air pressure will cause lift and make the airplane go up into the air. So it's all about forward motion and the shape of an airfoil and the flow of air above and below that. But they've actually done a number of studies, and they've really never been able to prove that. And there are actually a couple of other competing theories, which escape me at the moment, of why airplanes fly. But the important thing to appreciate is that there was a great article. I think this is probably 15 years ago in Aviation Week, maybe 15, 20 years ago, that said basically nobody knows why planes fly. We just know that if you design an airfoil with a certain shape and you push a plane forward fast enough at a certain velocity, it will lift up off the ground. That's all we know. When you get, it's really interesting too, when you get into the design manuals, and I have some experience as a design engineer, you know, aerospace engineer, it's really fascinating because they say things, you know, when they're telling you how to do certain types of design on certain parts of the structure, they say, well, you know, we don't really know why airplane structure will collapse under this particular set of forces. We just know that if you design using these standards, it won't crumple, it won't collapse. So it's kind of scary when you get into it, how many things that we take for granted we really don't know for sure with proof exactly how they work.
Right. Same thing with there was a thing with the bumblebee. They didn't know why the bumblebee could fly.
And yeah.
Some guys wrote a paper, I believe, in 2007 explaining it. And I read it, and I'm like, well, you didn't really explain it.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, it's really interesting. With, like, NASA is really good at describing something and acting like that's an explanation. You know, describing something is not the same as explaining it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, bumblebees are not aerodynamic at all, and yet they fly. Maybe they fly because they're supposed to.
Yeah, well, I mean, mosquitoes' wings beat at 200, 400 beats per second, and the thing is, as you go down smaller and smaller, it's supposed to be the wing beats are supposed to go up. You would think it'd go down, but that's not true. It goes up. And bumblebees are only at, like, 220. So they were like, well, we can't really explain that. Nor can we explain how they actually can make these jerky flight motions and stuff. They don't know.
Yeah.
Good luck figuring that one out. Now, what I wanted to ask you about, perhaps, is torsion fields involved in that? And do you think you could explain exactly what a torsion field is to the people who are hearing us say the word over and over and going, I have no idea what these guys are talking about?
That's a more difficult one, the second one. Let's just see with the first one. Yeah, you know, it's possible. It depends, because if you look at bees' wings, they almost kind of, they don't really flap up and down or in a linear fashion. They seem to kind of spin a little bit, like they kind of rotate around an axis to some extent. And maybe what's happening is that spin is actually negating the effects of gravity to some extent, especially at that higher rate. That's entirely possible that's what's going on. Because let's talk about torsion a little bit, because I talk about it in The Choice. One of the things that I discovered was that this research goes really far back into the 1940s and 50s in Russia. We just mentioned, I think, Dr. Nikolai Kozyrev did some great research on torsion. So basically, the idea of what's called a metric tensor torsion field was first come up with, I think, by Eli Kartan, and it was a derivative of something that Einstein had mentioned about the possibility of space-time or physical space twisting as opposed to just simply, you know, existing in a very kind of flat geometric way. So it turns out, as you dig into it, that there is a particular type of torsion, which essentially is a field generated by, let's say, an electron orbiting around a neutron. In other words, it's just orbiting around a small particle, and that spin action is creating an energetic force. But what they found when they delved into it was that force was so minute that it really could barely even be measured, much less accounted for, and it really couldn't account for anything very significant in terms of its effects on physical space. But there were experiments done in the 1970s, especially, where they found, and again, the name of the doctor escapes me, it's in The Choice, but the research is in there, that if you took, let's say, something that was spinning fairly rapidly, like a planet, and not only did you have it spinning on its axis, but you also put it into a second direction. In other words, you put it in motion, like, let's say, in an orbit around a sun, for instance. Okay. In other words, it was spinning not only on its axis, but it was also rotating around in another direction around the sun. You put it in two different – basically, you had two different forces acting on it, two different spins that it was experiencing,
right,
that you would get what was called dynamic torsion. And dynamic torsion was dramatically more powerful, and it seemed to have all these very, very interesting effects. And there were experiments done by Dr. Bruce De Palma in the 1970s, an ex-MIT physicist, where he had the famous spinning ball experiment, where he took one basically pinball that wasn't spinning and one that was spinning at 27,000 RPMs. And when they were ejected with equal force out of a test rig, the one that was spinning basically defied gravity. It went higher. It went farther. It dropped faster. It seemed to be somehow more energetic than the one that was not spinning, which violates one of Newton's laws. And it might really actually partially explain the bee, because if the bee is moving in a couple of different directions, then he's going to be actually negating the forces of gravity to some extent. If his wings are sort of spinning a little bit as opposed to just flapping back and forth, then you can create this almost negative energy field. Yeah. Because
they are spinning. You can go to YouTube and type in slow motion bumblebee,
right,
slow motion bee, and get it at 10,000 frames per second, and you can watch it going around, and it's beating down, but it's also going in a circle,
in a circular direction, and then if you've got, you know, two different wings going in slightly different circular directions, paths, then he's going to sort of defy gravity to some extent, just like the experiments did. So it's really fascinating stuff, and I think that it's something that, you know, Richard has talked about needing there to a lot more experimentation needs to be done. He's done some of it, but, you know, again, it always comes down to money to be able to do these things. And the other thing that was really a key factor was the faster something was spinning, the more dramatic this effect was. And the interesting thing was is that the effect is directional. It's not necessarily spherical in its distribution. In other words, there may be a reason why the bees jump and dance from here to here to here, because they are following the path of least resistance.
Right. And this might also explain why a lot of UFO witnesses say that the craft that they seen, that they took pictures of, that they filmed, but their witness testimony said that the craft was spinning.
Yeah, yeah.
This because is well known in UFO history that, I mean, people have always said, well, when they saw it, it seemed to be spinning.
Right, and when you spin, what the lesson is that when you spin stuff, basically you negate gravity, and that is, or at least you not necessarily negate it, but you minimize the effects of gravity, and that's phenomenal. And I, again, I go into a lot of detail in The Choice about the Explorer 1 missions and the very early missions to the moon, the Ranger series, and spinning gyros and all kinds of stuff like that, where we had a tremendous problem figuring out how to aim our spacecraft early on because there were spinning systems on them. And von Braun and the early mission planners at NASA couldn't figure out why they kept missing the moon by, 22,000 miles, for instance. Yeah, which, by the way, should be hitting the moon should be an extremely easy thing if Newton is right. Yeah, if Newton is correct, then hitting the moon should have been a piece of cake, and they missed it dramatically. So, torsion also has this spiraling aspect to it. In other words,
we're going to explain torsion.
Right, the beam itself, the torsion beam, again, as I said, it's considered directional, would also be this sort of spiraling left to right movement, almost like one half of a DNA double helix. Picture the double helix of the DNA. But just take one, and that would kind of be what a torsion beam would be like. And I think that's the way the universe moves. I bet if we could look at the universe from the outside of it, if there is anything outside the universe, we would see that the whole thing is twisting and spinning in that kind of spiraling motion. And again, I talk about all these different experiments in the book that relate this information. For instance, the sun's path around the center of the galaxy is not just a flat disk, circular line, but the solar system is also spiraling up and down around its path around the center of the galaxy. So that's, I think, the natural motion of everything in the universe. And why is this important? Let's go back to the Mayans for a second. And I don't mean to filibuster here, but I just, you know, get these things in my head and I want to talk about them.
No, no, I get that. But I'm just going to just clarify real quickly. It's this with the Earth moving through the solar system and the solar system moving through the spiral arm of the galaxy,
right.
The Earth is sort of doing it. It's spinning, then it's doing a spiral, and it's moving up and down.
Yeah, and the whole solar system is actually doing that.
Yeah.
So,
over to the Mayans.
Right, and the really interesting thing is that what the Mayans actually say, there's a monument, the Tortuguero Monument, number 6, I think it is, that John Major Jenkins and some other people have interpreted, and they say what it says is that the god Quetzalcoatl is going to ride a serpent rope from the center of the galaxy on December 21st, 2012, and manifest here in our three-dimensional reality and pass judgment on Earth and the human race. So if you think about it...
From now on, Quetzalcoatl will be known as Bob. Because it's just easier to say.
It's way easier to say Bob than Quetzalcoatl or Kukulcan. But if you think about it, what they're clearly talking about is they're clearly talking about the serpent rope that he's riding is this spinning, spiraling torsion beam from the center of the galaxy, which is what we're coming into, of course, alignment with on December 21st, 2012. And, you know, and it sounds kind of scary. It sounds like, oh, you know, Bob is going to show up here and he's going to pass judgment on us.
Right.
But again, what I'm trying to get across in the book is that I think we're misinterpreting judgment. When we think of judgment, we think of the westernized, biblical, you're good, you're bad, you go to heaven, you go to hell, you die, you live kind of judgment. But what I think the judgment is that the Mayans are talking about is that we are all going to have to judge ourselves, and from that, Bob Quetzalcoatl is going to make a judgment as to what we want done with the planet that we're occupying, and that I think is going to be the choice that we're going to make.
Which has a reflection to a lot of reports on NDEs. When people report after having been dead and being, you know, they've come back to life, and they report this experience of going through this tunnel of light, and then they meet
a spiraling tunnel.
A spiraling tunnel of light.
Yeah,
sure.
Right.
And then they come out of it, and you can also, this has also been described in LSD trips and DMT and all these other things, the same similar effects. As when they sort of break through this dimension into another dimension,
right?
Hyperdimensional dimension, and they get this choice where, you know, you can stay if you want, you can stay here if you want, but you also can go back and, you know, live out some time, and there's maybe some things that you have to do. There's still things on the table that need to be done. They don't have to be done, but you can do them if you like.
Yeah,
and then people have that choice from this being of love, this ball of energy that says, you know, either stay or go. And they go, well, you know what? I want. There's some things I still need to do. Now that you pointed them out, you're right. I remember that stuff now. And yes, I want to go back and do that. Okay, off you go.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the ones that choose to stay, we never hear about their reports.
No, obviously we won't hear about them until after we join them wherever they are.
So this does have sort of a connection, you know, to this concept that you have of being given a choice instead of you're good, you're bad, you go to fifth dimensional Earth, you stay in three dimensional Earth.
Yeah, you know, and the Mayans go on to say that at the end of this time that we will all face our own personal hall of mirrors. And we will essentially judge ourselves. So I think the process of 2012 is that, you know, we face our reality. We look at who we really are, what we've really done, and we choose maybe the spiritual or the material. And I suspect that the more people that choose the spiritual path, if 50.00001% of us choose that, then we go forward. If we choose the material path or we choose not to continue this planet the way it's been going for the last couple thousand years anyway, or 26,000 years, then we start over again. And I personally, I'd really rather not start over again because I don't have my Porsche yet, and you know, there's some things that are undone. And I think that's what it's all about. So, you know.
So do you think on December 21st, 2012, there's going to be a planetary gong that goes off like the old gong show? Or do you think it's like an open time frame? Because we have from 1980 to 2016,
right.
There's this pulse wave. So it's a time period. So do you think on the December 21st, 2012, everybody's going to have to wake up and make that choice that moment, that, you know, the gong's gone off, guys, make your choice.
Well, I think that it's going to be an internal spiritual choice. You know, okay. I think it's going to be, I don't think it's going to be something we're going to consciously have to experience. But what I suspect will happen then is that the world will start to move in the direction that we choose to move it into. So in other words, you know, like I said, maybe all 2012 is about is just that 50.00001% of us decide that we like it, we're going to go forward with what's going on here, mm-hmm. and then it may take another 100 years, 200 years, 1,000 years for the better world that we've chosen to make to manifest itself. You know, because we have all these souls on this planet that we're going to have to kind of bring around to our side. So I don't know that I expect anything specifically spectacular to happen on that day, but what I think is that whatever choice we've made, we're going to start to then experience that in 3D probably from that point forward, although realistically we're already in this transitional phase, we're already experiencing it. You know, all the upheavals that are going on with our governments and our monetary systems. You know, you look at what's been going on in Washington, D.C., it's really obvious that the way...
Greece and a couple years ago, Iceland and...
Yeah. It's just going to keep happening, and obviously we cannot continue to go down the path that we are on right now. We have to shift paths some way. It's just a question of which way are we going to go.
I think there's some serious... I have a joke about when the universe tells you something. The universe will whisper in your ear. It'll say, Scott, maybe you should do that.
Right.
And then if you don't, like, pay attention, it might get a little louder and say, hey, Scott, you remember that thing I was talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you probably should do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you ignore that. You have too much noise going on in your own head thinking about your own self. And eventually a 2x4 flies out of the center of the universe and smacks you in the back of the head.
Right.
And once you come back to consciousness, you go, all right, I should probably do that.
The thing is, I think that's partly what's going on with me with the physical stuff that we talked about before the show. You know, I'm having some back problems and I got some pain. And, you know, I think my body's just saying, dude, you got to take a little bit better care of me here. So, you know, I've kind of been getting the little whispers and the little signals, and now it's really hitting me.
Yeah, you got the 2x4 in the back of the head now.
I just got the 2x4. I really did, and I kind of
the universe
like,
will do that, and I'm sort of a stubborn guy, so I generally get the 2x4.
Yeah. Probably most of us do.
Come right down to it. I'm generally getting the 2x4 in the back of the head before I listen to the universe, because the universe is just in another aspect of me saying, you know, your path is over here. Your path is over here. You know, there's that old joke about the guy praying to God to save him. He's on the roof of his house and there's a flood. And the floodwaters rising and rising and rising. And he's praying to God to help him. And the boat comes by with the guys in it and say, come on, jump in. We're here to save you. And he goes, no, God will save me. And they go away. And then another bigger boat comes and they say, jump on, hurry. And the waters are rising. He says, no, God will save me. And this goes on until he ends up drowning.
The helicopter comes.
Yep, yeah, he drowns and goes, God, why didn't you save me? What do you mean? I sent two boats and a helicopter.
Yeah, what are you talking about, dude? I sent you two boats and a helicopter.
Yeah.
That's it. That's it exactly. So, you know, yeah, it's hard, though. I mean, it's really hard when you want something in personality, you know, to kind of take what they give you rather than what you're asking for.
Right. See, the discernment process is getting yourself tuned in enough to hear it when it's a whisper instead of a – I'm still working on that, by the way.
yeah.
From a whisper to a 2x4 in the back of the head, I'm working on that. It might take another – maybe on December 21st, 2012, I'll wake up and go, okay, I heard that. Got it.
Yeah, hopefully.
Good. Well, we're sorry, but we got to take a quick break right now, and we'll see you guys on the other side.
You've always been told to think about the alternative. Well, we can do better. We can show you. AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com will improve your health, well-being, and lifestyle through hundreds of different products, from herbs and well-being products to our large selection of specialty clothing, jewelry, and more. We ship around the world with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. There's always new products and amazing specials. Let us show you at AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com.
Hello, this is Scott Jordan, and I would personally like to thank all of our listeners for their emails of encouragement. It means a great deal to us. All of Spectrum shows are available in two formats, an MP3 stream you can listen to on our site, as well as a YouTube version. All of Spectrum shows are full length and free to listen to, and if I have my way, always will be. Tom and myself do all this work out of pocket, and freely give our time and effort to giving you, the listener, the best, most informative experience possible. I would also like to thank our listeners who have donated in the past to help with our expenses. Every donation goes directly to keeping the project alive. Thank you, enjoy, and keep listening.
Are you suffering from constant pain in the knee, shoulder, wrist, and other parts of your body? Needle-free acupuncture with Lapingo Life Pads may be the answer. Lapingo Life Pads combine ancient wisdom with modern nanotechnology and advanced engineering. They're designed to relieve pain naturally with no needles and no side effects. That's Lepingo, lapingoproducts.com.
Okay, so we've pretty much explained what torsion field physics is, or is there anything more you want to add to that?
No. I think it's fairly clear. I mean, for more detail, I would say go to the book, go to the choice, and look at the hyperdimensional physics stuff that's in there, and also Dark Mission. That stuff is covered in more detail there. So I don't think we need to go into tremendous depth. If people want more depth, they can pick the book up.
So. All right. So December 21st, 2012. You told me your experience. Have you got any other information or any other leads that fit in with what we're talking about?
Well, I have some friends out here in LA and in other places. One of them is a friend, a guy named Michael Curry, who is a rather well-known psychic, actually. He is famously known to have read for Princess Diana and President Reagan and some other people like that. He's somebody that I trust a lot. His skills, his talents are, I think unmatched. He's very talented. But what he told me is that right now that there are more ghosts, spirits, incarnated or not incarnated on this planet, on Earth, than he has ever seen in his entire lifetime, and he's in his 50s.
Okay.
And we're trying to figure out what does this mean to 2012. And I think it means that all the spirits are here because everybody wants to know what's going to happen. Everybody wants to know what our choice is going to be. That's why it's so interesting. That's why I think extraterrestrials are here. And I think we're going to have more and bigger and very dramatic UFO sightings over the next few years. And I wouldn't even be surprised if, aliens start popping up on street corners.
Right.
And then turning a corner and disappearing in the back into the fourth dimension from whence they came or something. Because I think that everybody is here right now during this time because everybody is probably the best show in this part of the galaxy. What are the humans going to do with their planet? What are they going to decide to do? Are they going to start all over again, or are they going to go forward and into something better? So
they loaded up the popcorn.
Yeah, exactly.
And they come out to watch the show.
You can poo-poo psychics all you want, but I have a friend who's kind of actually a life coach also, and she started out as my pet psychic, and his name is Denise Zach, and she has a website called Tales of the Heart, so I'll give her a little plug there.
Cool.
And it it kind of started with a cat that I had that's since passed on about 3 years ago. And I thought, well, you know, her birthday's coming up on July 11th, and I thought it would be kind of fun for my blog to just, you know, do an interview with a pet psychic, right? So I called, of all people, Richard C. Hoagland, and he told me about Denise, who had been on Coast to Coast AM a few times, so it was sort of the on-staff pet psychic for Coast to Coast.
Okay.
I know this sounds silly, but... But anyway, she, you know, we got going on the reading. I wanted to talk to another kitty that had previously passed away, and what was really fascinating to me during those first couple readings with those two cats was that their real personalities came through in a way that she could not have known, because I didn't
right.
tell her anything about it.
Because you're looking for the signs of cold reading, you know. They could just
right.
say anything and be like, oh, I love you, I miss you.
Yeah.
Yes, the grass is greener on the other side. I'm having fun chasing mice around.
Right.
And you could go, oh, that's so cute.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And they could have just made it up out of their ass, right?
Yeah, no, but she clearly, it was interesting because the difference in tone and language was what I noticed. It's like their personality fit exactly with the two animals' personalities. And so I thought that was really interesting. And I was having some trouble with my older kitty, and she said, do these things, and I did those things, and the behavior absolutely just stopped within 2 or 3 days. It just was exactly and the other thing too that Denise did that really impressed me was that she did not give me the easy answer. She could have done what you said and just given
yeah.
me the easy answer. She gave me the hard, tough, emotional, sometimes very painful answers to hear, which if she wanted to keep me as a client, I don't think she would have done.
Yeah,
you know?
Probably.
So that happened, and you know, I knew about Denise, and I think I'd done one or two other sessions with her after that, and then Indy, my cat that I'd primarily been interested in talking to, said she wanted a little friend, that she was lonely, just her, and when I would travel, it would, you know, really wasn't good for her. So I went out to search for a friend for her, and I found this little cat, which I named Aurora, and brought her home, and she was a kind of a rescue kitty and wasn't in, you know, all that great a shape. But so I thought, you know, hey, for fun again, why don't I do a reading with Aurora? So I called Denise up, and we got a picture. She works from picture, so she can do it from Chicago where she lives. And,
okay.
And so I started saying things, and I said, you know, oh, you know, Aurora's really scared. She won't really let me pet her. She runs away from me all the time. And, you know, what's going on with her, and is there anything that I can do to further this relationship? And then he said, well, she's really, really worried about her kittens, and especially her male kitten, because she hasn't seen him since before they were all trapped, captured by the rescue. And I said, okay, you know, Aurora had three kittens with her, and they were all females, so she doesn't have a male kitten. And Denise goes, no, she's telling me that there's a male, and she wants to know, you know, what's going on with him, what happened. And I'm like, okay, whatever. So, you know, I talked to Denise, and I hung up, and it just bothered me for a couple of days, right? Like, okay, it bugged me. I thought to myself, you know, why are you not taking it seriously? Because the thing she's told you to do before have worked, so, you know, why don't you try to find out what's going on? So I called up the lady that was her foster at this rescue thing.
Right.
And I said, you know, did Aurora have a male kitten? And she says, oh, yeah, she had a male kitten. There were three females and one male, and they were all captured together. And then, you know, the little male kitten was really, really sick. But she goes, I worked with him, and I nursed him, I thought, back to health. And then right before the two-week separation period was over and we brought them all back together, he died. And I said, so wait a minute. You're telling me that after you catch all the cats, you then separate them and don't let them see each other? And she said, oh, yeah, we keep them separate for 2 or 3 weeks before we allow them to come back together. So, okay, male kitten out of a litter of 3 or 4 cats, 50-50 call on that one. Logically, there's going to be some males and some females, right?
Right.
Not a big deal. But not only did she know that there was a missing male cat, Denise also knew that they had been kept separate from each other.
Right.
When they were captured. And there's no way that Denise could have known that because I didn't know that. And
right.
I had never – so I didn't tell her that. And I never knew that. I didn't know that at all. And so I hung up the phone, and that completely freaked me out. And that was when I realized that some people just have an amazing gift of intuitive ability. And this is interesting and relevant to the choice because in the book what I talk about is that there were experiments done at SRI, and I know you have some experience with the folks over at SRI.
Yeah.
With ESP, especially back in the 70s. They did a lot of this stuff, 60s and 70s. And at some point, a doctor, I believe James Spottiswood was his name, did some studies where he tried to determine whether there was any sort of pattern to the ESP scores. And what he found was that at a specific time, 1330 LST, local sidereal time, that there was a notable spike in...
I remember that study.
In human intuition, right? Yeah. In human intuition. Now, what the heck is local sidereal time? Well, local sidereal time is, to put it simply, the time when over your geographic location, the constellation of Sagittarius is most directly overhead. Well, what's in the constellation of Sagittarius? Well, there's a star called Sagittarius A, which is right in alignment with what everybody now thinks is a supermassive, incredibly fast, rapidly spinning black hole or singularity, not necessarily a black hole, energetic object, which is spinning incredibly fast, moving through space in that two-directional torsion thing. It's got the spin on its axis plus the rotational movement through space, and it's firing off. I think it's the source of all the life energy in this galaxy. You know, it's like the sun is the source of the original life energy in this solar system. The singularity at the center of the galaxy is the source of all the life energy in the galaxy itself. So when you are most directly aligned with the center of the galaxy is when your intuition is most prominent. And there's LST calculators, local sidereal time calculators on the web. For us here in LA, where I live, the LA area, it's about between 9:15 and 10:15 at night. It kind of depends on whether the calculator corrects for daylight savings time or
right.
not.
Right.
But, you know, it's so funny because when I tell people this and that your intuition spikes basically during these periods that you can get greater insight, they're like, yeah, you know, some girls are like, oh, I take a shower at night before I go to bed. And it's like, I always seem to have the most amazing thoughts about 10 o'clock at night when I'm in the shower or something. And it's because we're in this physical alignment with this energy that, by the way, Richard Hoagland in some experiments actually measured at one point, this torsion energy that's being pulsed out of the center of the galaxy. So, you know.
Yeah, he actually made a device and did it, and also went on a show and did it on the top of the pyramid.
Right, right.
He made this device up that would, you know, pick up the – it was had to do with like little tuning forks.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and I forget the guy who came up with the idea and who manufactured it, but I think I've got those facts in the choice. But basically the idea was that, okay, a tuning fork is going to be sensitive to torsional energy because essentially vibration is partial rotation, and, you know, and the other part of the rotation is probably taking place in a higher spatial dimension, like the fourth dimension. But that back and forth motion is going to make it really sensitive. So he took tuning forks out of an old Accutron watch, and he basically hooked these watches up to some very sensitive instruments and set them up at different places and took measurements. And he did many experiments, particularly during the Venus transit of 2004, which is going to be repeated in 2012, mm-hmm. second of the set of two Venus transits. And essentially that's an eclipse of Venus between the Earth and the Sun.
Right.
And happens pretty infrequently. And the little thing, the little recorder, you know, went nuts recording this energy. It was definitely influenced by this torsion energy that was being created by the alignment of the Earth, Venus, and the Sun. And he also did experiments specifically on December 21st, 2005, and then on into the next month, and found that about every 9 days there was this unaccountable energetic pulse of energy that was related to the center of the galaxy, and was making his little instrument, his little tuning fork instrument, go kind of crazy. And the interesting thing was is that as you got to the into January, early January, the energy, the signal actually got more intense. And again, given that torsion tends to be directional, like a lighthouse beam, we're kind of now thinking, and I put this in the choice, that the center of the galaxy sends this pulse out about every 9 days, and during the winter solstice period is when we're most closely in the path of that torsional pulse of energy, and that's probably what's going to hit us rather dramatically, you know, in 2012. And in fact, it has obviously been hitting us between.
Well, yeah, there's a bunch of lineups on 2012.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm reading that December time frame, December to January.
Right.
There's a whole bunch of different alignments for the center of the galaxy that's going to be. And if these objects do sort of are like multipliers.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
if you can line them up and everything's like a transducer multiplier, the energy goes in, gets multiplied, gets sent to the next, gets goes in,
right.
gets sent to the next, multiplied. You know, by the time it hits Earth, it's like a tsunami.
Right, and the question is, you know, what are we going to do with that energy? Because really, I think the energy from the center of the galaxy is neutral, and it's a question of how are we going to, you know, how are we going to utilize that extra energy that we're going to get? Are we
right.
going to turn it to something positive and good, or is it going to cause the kind of problems that they've had in you know previous incarnations of man? I don't know. It's up to us.
I don't know. I don't know whether you can. Whether it'd be interesting if we could track these things back through the earlier civilizations, like when Atlantis fell, and you know back in earlier mm-hmm. times. And of course, we were talking with Michael Cremo just a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about this, the Rig Veda and the Vedas, and how there are cycles within cycles. Because he said, well, the Yuga cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Which we're currently in now, you know, extends for another, you know, good deal of time. I says, okay, so we're good for 2012, December 21st, 2012. And he said, not really. He says, because there are cycles within these cycles.
Right, right. And, you know, what's really interesting is that I talk about the Yuga cycles in the book and in the choice. And what's really interesting is that if you look at when it's generally agreed the current, you know, Yuga cycle began, it's right around 3114 BC, and the current Mayan calendar long count cycle of 5125 years began in about 3102 BC,
right.
I want to say. So that's basically exactly the same time. And so what that means is that the Yuga cycle, and I did this thing in the book where I basically said, look, if you take the numbers of the Yuga cycles, you can divide them up by 5125, and it comes out not only to a precessional cycle, but it comes out – in other words, the Yuga cycles also use this 5125-year cycle within a cycle. And
mm-hmm.
what that means is I think we have a 2012 era that's basically going to incorporate, you know, from now, which had already started, up to about 2023. So I think we're not going to be out of the 2012 woods until about 2023.
Right.
And so, you know, yeah, it all fits, and they all it's really interesting as I got into the research how everything really numerically, mathematically, and calendrically, as if that's a word, fit perfectly together for this period of about 10 or 12 years that we're going through.
Mhm. It's a cyclical sort of a thing. And that's what Michael Cremo was talking about was with his studies of the Vedas in general. And I think when we talk to some of our other guests, specifically about the Rig Veda, and at that point we were talking about how the Rig Veda talks about these the gods
mm-hmm.
and lights in the sky and all the stuff we're seeing now.
Exactly, yeah.
All this stuff we're seeing now is talked about in the Rig Veda when they specifically say there were the lights in the skies and people came out of the craft and landed on the ground and communicated mm-hmm. with them at a specific time.
Right.
Not
right.
before, but when a certain time, then the lights, you know, were no longer just lights in the sky. They were lights on the ground and
mm-hmm.
there were people coming out and they called them the gods or they called them, you know, a variety of names.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they started their, okay, we're ready to talk to you now.
Yeah, well, you know, and not only that, but it's really important to understand about these cycles is this, and it has to do with stellar motions and the concept we talked about of everything being constantly in motion. Now, the cycle we're talking about is there's the broad Yuga cycles. We also have the 26,000-year precessional cycle, and we are absolutely repeating a 26,000-year precessional cycle. And some people think that, you know, in other words, the sun and the earth, the sun, the earth, the center of the galaxy alignment, the last time that took place was 26,000 years ago. So a lot of people point to that and say that's when Atlantis fell or the previous high civilization fell.
Yeah.
Or you can be at the oppositions, which is, you know, you're halfway around the big circle you're making of 13,000 years ago.
Right, right. 12,500,
right.
The evidence on the pyramids.
Right, right. And all that great stuff that Graham Hancock and Robert Bovall did. What's his name? Adrian. There's another couple of other great books. But the point I want to make is this: is that even though the cycles repeat themselves, the results of the cycles don't have to repeat themselves, because even though the Earth and the Sun and the center of the galaxy and all that stuff is lining up in the same way, which I think means we're going to have the same kind of choice: do we move forward or do we stop? Everything else is in a different position. You know, every other star, in other words, everything is still moving, so all the other stars are in a different position than they were the last time that we came into this alignment. The galaxy is in a different position relative to all the other galaxies than it was, so there's still variation. You know, we're going to get the same kind of choice, which is probably to be or not to be, right?
Right. It's almost...
Right? But it's not guaranteed that we're going to have the same results as we had before, because everything else in the universe is in a different place than it was. It's in a different physical place.
Exactly.
And even where this alignment is taking place is, you know, where was the solar system 26,000 years ago, maybe, or 13,000 years ago, the last time we had a choice like this? It was, gosh, it was way the heck in another part of the universe. It was, you know, we moved pretty fast. I don't know exactly where it was, but the bottom line is,
we're not there.
Yeah, all measurements are relative to other objects, and every object is moving, so we're never in the same place twice. So even though we have the same choice to make, the results do not have to be the same.
Yeah, I mean, there was a Peruvian culture that when the Spanish landed, they just went up in the mountains and went down into the cave system and stayed there. I call that stepping to the left.
Yeah.
You know, you can confront what's coming head on and go, okay, with these, their wise men were saying, this event is just about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Here are our options. Options are, we can go down to the beaches and walk on them and hope it doesn't happen. Or we can go down to the beaches and confront them when they show up and get the jump on them.
Mm-hmm.
Or we can step to the left. And by stepping to the left, they just went down into the mountains and into their cave systems and hung out there until the Spanish left.
Right.
Then they came back out again.
Right.
And the reason they said they came back out again was because of the prophecy that this time period that's coming up is a time period of choice. That was their words. It's a period of choice. Because one of the people talking to them said, but if it's prophecy, why would you come out and tell us we're all doomed?
Yeah.
And they said, oh, no, that's not the way it works. The way it works is you're not doomed and you're not guaranteed to have, you know, the best thing possible happen.
Yeah, you know, everybody
you
walks out.
You have a choice.
Yeah.
This is your choice. We have to come out and talk about the prophecy, because prophecies don't mean it's locked in stone. It doesn't mean that this is the path you're on, whether you like it or not, sort of thing. It's like you have the choice whether to do it one way or do it another way. And he says, you know, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. We're here to witness the choice. We're not here to, you know, and we're also here to warn you, if you don't stop your ways,
yeah,
you know, it can go badly.
Get more in harmony with the way we're supposed to be living on the earth. Yeah.
Exactly. And it backs up exactly with what you're saying. And a lot of the ancient cultures talk about this sort of, this isn't a random event of one culture.
No.
No. This is down the line. They're all talking about, just like down the line, if you look back into all ancient cultures, they all talk about the visitors, the gods, the guides, the messengers, the whatever name you want to give it.
Right.
They all talk about someone from out there coming here and giving them information.
Yeah, the Nephilim and those who from heaven to earth came down and all that stuff. Yeah,
the Anunnaki for the Sumerians, and you know, different names from different cultures. They all have different names. They all have different stories, but the stories sort of all match up. That's the key.
Right.
If you can connect the data points. Now, it doesn't matter whether these are beings from Zeta Reticuli or other human beings that have evolved to a certain point in Earth history where they've developed space travel and left here.
Yeah.
And come back and said, hey, guys, just so you know, you may want to stop doing what you're doing because it sucks.
Yeah.
And you're going to just trust us. We know.
it didn't work out so well on the last planet we were on. So, yeah. You might want to move on from this. Yeah.
And it can be a mix of – and I'm not even I'm not even saying it's one or the other. It doesn't have to be, you know, ancient humans from, you know, what, millions of years ago, Michael Cremo, and or aliens from other star systems. What about both?
Right.
What about any, all?
Yeah, how about all of them? Because, you know, I mean, again, I think things are going to get weird as we get into this sort of location in space and things start to change. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised by anything that happens, and I do expect you know, we've had a lot of really weird UFO sightings over cities and so forth. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, plus not only that, we've had I know it's becoming cliche now, but our weather is sort of weird.
You know, I don't know that I agree with that all that much. We've had two very cool summers here in Los Angeles.
I'm talking about mile-wide tornadoes that have never seen before in the history of Earth.
Well, no, but that's not true. They have been seen before, and it's really interesting. There have, you know, this weather pattern is, if you go back 50 or 100 years, you do find examples of these same kinds of things that we're seeing now. And you know, I think it's very related to the sun's activity.
Right.
And I mean, I think it's unprecedented in our lifetimes, but it's not unprecedented in the history of the Earth.
Okay, we're going to talk about cyclical events. Then I would agree with you 100% because cyclically, there's nothing new under the sun.
Well, I mean, you know, I guess there was a rainstorm in the 1800s that flooded, you know, huge, vast amounts of California. And you know, if it happened today, you know, Sacramento would be underwater and so forth. And these things can happen. They do happen. It's interesting because what I think's going on with the weather, and I'm not acknowledging it's not different than it was 10 years ago. What I'm questioning is whether it's completely unprecedented. I, you know, if you listen closely, you'll hear news reports where, you know, it's the biggest hurricane since 1950 or it's the second biggest, you know,
since 1890,
tornado, whatever. So it is unusual in that sense. It's unusual. I don't think it's unprecedented. But what, you know, what's interesting, I didn't really get a chance to get into this in the book too much, but there's these HAARP devices that are placed, you know, around the world. We've got one in Alaska. We've got one in Puerto Rico. The Europeans have one in Norway.
We got birds falling out of the sky.
Right.
Cows dropping dead.
Right. The Russians have one. And it's really interesting because if you look at the magnetic North Pole, it's been moving northward for quite some time, and it started to move extremely rapidly in about the last 20 or 25 years. And then all of a sudden, just a couple of years ago, it basically took a sharp right-hand turn, went due east, and at the present rate that it's going, it's going to end up in Russia somewhere. And so what I suspect has happened is that the magnetic field is kind of pulled over to the right and pulled up a little bit, and we're all kind of getting, you know, we're getting slightly different weather than we used to get because the pattern's been changed because the magnetic North Pole has been changed. Now, I think personally that what's doing this is these HAARP devices. And I actually think it's benevolent. A lot of people want to say that HAARP is this evil mind control thing, but there were some studies that I talk about in The Choice that were done by like RAND Corporation in the 60s that basically said if the magnetic North Pole and the physical North Pole actually align or come close together, the crust of the Earth could kind of rip apart and flip over, the planet could flip over, and it would be a really bad day for everybody. Now, since that study, I think that we've kind of moved away from that that as a possibility. But it's, I think that they're definitely are using these devices to try to keep the magnetic pole from coming up and meeting with the North Pole, just because there's a 30 or 40% chance that something really bad would happen. So you know, I think that's partially causing the weird weather.
It's not like our magnetic poles haven't flipped in Earth's history.
No, and it hasn't, you know, it hasn't really been, there's no indication it caused any kind of mass extinction. It's just the weather changed. And personally, I'm kind of enjoying not having to use my air conditioner. You know, I live at the beach, and I have a portable air conditioner, and I haven't had to turn it on in 2 years. So awesome. I'm kind of fine with that. I mean, I don't mind year-round 65 to 75 degree temperatures. It's kind of nice.
You'll manage, yeah.
Now, I'm sorry. I know the rest of you are dying in the heat.
Sorry about the tsunamis and everything, guys.
Well, you know, it's funny. I used to live in Toronto, where you are, or the Toronto area, and it's like, you know, I mean, Toronto, Canada is both the coldest and the hottest place I have ever been in my life. I mean,
humidity is just will just crush you.
The first week I was there was, I think, June of 1994, and it the Humidex, you know, the humidity and the heat index combined, they said was 130 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
And I mean, I would get out of my car and try to walk into my hotel where I was staying, and that 30 or 40 or 50 foot walk felt, again, it felt like I was carrying an elephant on my shoulder.
Yeah, like you're walking through hell.
Yeah, and then in the wintertime, around Christmas time, you know, you go through those periods where it's like minus 47 degrees centigrade, and
yeah.
I mean, and it's so dry that you touch your cat's nose and there's a huge spark that flies between it, and oh my God, I was like, what is this place? It's insanity, you know,
I want to go to Miami.
Yeah, I want to go somewhere else. Actually, I don't want to go to Miami. I love the West Coast with that air conditioning, the natural air conditioning we have.
Yeah, that's the thing. We in the summers, like right now, we just recently went through a massive heat wave, and you don't even want to leave your house. You know, we got three air conditioners running in the house here.
I remember.
I don't want to leave. I just you walk outside and this heat blast hits you in the face, and you're like, okay, go back in.
it's like a hairdryer.
It's like hairdryer.
You know, I lived in Toronto for about 3 or 4 years. I lived in Minneapolis for about 7 years. And the thing is that, look, there's 2 weeks in the fall and 2 weeks in the spring where it's perfect.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Other than that, you're either too cold or too hot. So
exactly. That's exactly the way it goes. Okay, yeah. I understand that. Okay, you say that there's substantial scientific proof of what you call the God force. Mm-hmm. And I believe you mentioned this in your book, The Choice.
Yeah.
What is that proof?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different research that's been done over the years and stuff that people have probably heard of, and it's all related to the same thing, and I don't think everybody puts it together. It's really interesting when I was researching that part of the book. I mean, I obviously looked at Kirlian photography, and there are skeptics out there that just totally trash Kirlian and say that it's just moisture. And there's the cases we've heard of where they will snip a leaf, and they will put the leaf back down on the plate and take a second photograph, and you can still see the faint signature of the part of the leaf that was severed.
Yeah.
And you know, the argument is, well, it's just leftover moisture, except the truth is that they don't always put the leaf back down in the exact same location, so it can't be leftover moisture from when the leaf was laying there before. And there's other photographs of, for instance, when a couple was arguing and they both put their fingers on the plate, there was a physical bar. You could see a bar between their two auras, their two fingers.
Right.
And,
like a connection.
Yeah. There wasn't a connection. It was a bar that was like between the two of them. Like it was horizontal across it. And then there was another example of a couple that was, you know, really saying nice things to each other, how much they loved each other, and their two auras merged together and they were red in color. And so there was this interesting stuff like this that I put in there. And that stuff is kind of anecdotal until you start to get into other things like the work of Clive Baxter, who I don't know, I assume you've heard of him because I know you're pretty up on this stuff. And he was a polygraph expert for the CIA and basically did lie detector tests. And what he did was...
Secret Life of Plants.
Yeah, the Secret Life of Plants. And what he did was just plugged a typical house plant up to a lie detector machine and was getting some just general background electrical activity on his machine. And then he had a thought, I wonder what will happen if I burn one of the leaves. And the polygraph went absolutely nuts. It shot through the roof. I mean, it just basically went crazy.
The second he had the thought.
The instant he had the thought. And the thing about it that's so fascinating is that in the experiments he did later on, he not only could the plant, you know, would the plant react every time faster than light, basically, over vast distances. And Brian O'Leary was actually involved in some of this research.
Yeah. We should probably talk about Brian because Brian recently passed, and July 29th, 2011.
Yeah.
And he did an amazing amount of things. You know, he spent his whole life banging on the doors of the free energy paradigm. So it's interesting that you mentioned Brian O'Leary was involved in that.
We will talk about him. And you know, the main thing was is that the plants ultimately could tell the difference between when he actually intended to harm them, burn a leaf, cut a leaf off, and when he was just thinking that. They did not react when they – in other words, they knew his intent. So there is this energy field absolutely between all living things and even what we consider to be inanimate things, I believe, that we're all connected. And you know, Baxter's experiment stands unchallenged. They've been challenged, but they've not been successfully challenged. And that
he took it one step further. His assistant, he took a scoop of his flesh, skin, mm-hmm. and he hooked the machine up to that. Mm-hmm. And he had his assistant, who was traveling, make notes in it. Like, so when he was waiting in line at the airport and he was upset that there was 30 people in front of him, and oh my right. God, I'm gonna have to stand in this line. He would take his notebook out and write that down,
right? The time and everything.
The time and everything. And whenever he was having a, you know, he was eating some ice cream and he was feeling really good about life, he'd write that down. And back in the city, the Baxter was writing down, was watching the polygraph mm-hmm. on his skin and recording all of the ups and downs on that. And then when he came back, he put all the information together and went and seen an amazing similarity and
right.
and connection. So this just goes to the spooky action at a distance stuff.
Yeah, and you know, so the reality is that there is something that connects all of us. You know, they used to call it the ether in science, and it's an energetic field that's around every living thing, and like I said, I think every inanimate thing, and we're all connected. And the other thing too that this kind of brings up for me is that the people that are vegetarian because they don't like, you know, the fear and the pain that animals go through when they're slaughtered, well, the same thing happens with plants. I mean, you know, if you're out there to harvest the cabbage crop, the cabbage knows you're going to dig it up from the ground, chop it up, and eat it. So I don't think that there's any – I'm just saying that there's no moral superiority to being vegetarian. The plants
– right.
experience things just as much as the animals do. So, you know, I'm not criticizing vegetarians. If you want to eat that way, that's great for
you. Yeah, more power,
to
you.
But
if you're starving in the Andes and somebody offers you a yak with cheese, take it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not necessarily more moral because, you know, everything that is killed or cut or whatever, it's going to experience pain. I mean, it's an inevitable, I guess, fact of existence in this three-dimensional universe.
So that what all of these experiments sort of lead to this concept of a field.
Right, exactly, of a field of something around all of us. And like I said, in the old days, they called it the ether, and I talk a lot about that on The Choice also.
And this field is all interconnected.
Yep, absolutely. And where I say the connections are is through higher spatial dimensions, not through something physical, some sort of fluid physical thing that we can experience in three mm-hmm. dimensions.
That we're going to find in CERN.
Yeah, exactly. That we're going to find in CERN. It's a behind the scenes connection. It's the what's the word Richard
An used? Underlying.
It's the underlying substrate which supports everything, and it's probably that which. You know, which is what's holding all the galaxies together, which don't have nearly enough mass to create the gravity to hold galaxies together. I mean, according to our observations, everything in the universe should be flying apart, not sticking together, yet it sticks together quite nicely. So
right, and with the mass being, most of it being empty space,
Yeah.
Well, it's empty space because it's not observable phase space.
Right.
If it's a hyper-dimensional space, that's, you know, that's why you're never going to find a – take a picture of a gluon.
Yeah, you never – you know, we talked about dark matter, I think, before the show started, about how ridiculous the idea of dark matter is. There's all this missing mass and missing stuff that's holding everything together, and that is actually, I think, all of that glue is in a higher dimension, the fourth dimension, the ninth dimension, whatever it is. And that's why it's the search for dark matter is just absolutely ridiculous, because there really isn't any physical three-dimensional matter that's doing this. You know, God's glue is something we can't comprehend. And, you know, I just think it's clearly something that exists at a higher level. And all we get here in this three dimensions is just sort of the reflection, the ripples and the waves of that field.
Yeah, a three-dimensional expression from a multi-dimensional existence.
Right, exactly. And a multi-dimensional...
I just made that shit up.
Ripple. No, it's good, but it's not. It's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, we've managed to cover a lot of areas in the 2 hours that we've had with you. I think what we'll do now is I want to get information on what your website is, your blog information. Also, if you're going to be doing any talks or lectures, do you have any projects coming up? And where can people buy your book called The Choice?
Yes, projects. That's so Canadian. My website is mikebarra.com. It's just www.mikebarra.com. It's just one R. So you can go to mikebarra.com. That's where I blog. That's where I have my upcoming schedule of appearances. It's where I've got links to my books and some various DVDs and things, videos I've got on YouTube. So that's the main place to go. You can also sign up for a newsletter. I try to get something out once a month, but with all the things that have been going on in my personal life, it hasn't been as easy to do that lately as I wanted it to be. But mikebarra.com is the place to go. And you can also find me on Facebook. And just look me up there, and I'm glad to friend up with people on Facebook. I don't quite have my 5,000 friend limit yet, so we can still be friends on Facebook. You can also connect with me on Twitter, and I'm MikeBarra33 on Twitter. And those are the main places. You know, everything's kind of interconnected through MikeBarra.com. You can get to all my stuff that way.
Was 33 choice of the... was it an age choice? A lot of people pick their age.
No, it wasn't. It was it's the 33 degrees of the Scottish Rite Freemasons, just to kind of mess with people's heads a little bit. It's kind
Mike Barra is now one of the elite guys.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. But don't let the secret out, because it's kind of fun to play with people a little bit.
I will.
So that, you know, that's the main thing. The book is called The Choice: Using Conscious Thought and Physics of the Mind to Reshape the World. You can find it in any Barnes & Noble. Any Borders that's still open should probably still have a copy of it. Amazon.com, you can get it on Kindle.
We'll put it on our website as well.
That would be great.
Everything about Mike Barra will be on the past guest show tomorrow on our website, www.spectrumradionetwork.com. Okay. You can go to past guests. You'll see Mike Barra there on the top, and all of his links and information and everything you ever wanted to know about Mike.
More than you want to know.
More than you ever wanted to know about Mike.
And one last thing, Scott. I'm going to be on some episodes of Ancient Aliens this third season, which has just started. So look for me on Ancient Aliens. I did some season 2 episodes, and I've done a few more here for season 3. So hopefully
that Ancient Alien series is gaining a huge amount of people viewing.
Yeah, you know, I think they're kind of running out of subjects, though, and I'm really trying to get them to do for season 4 to do Ancient Aliens on the Moon and Ancient Aliens on Mars, because between me and Richard,
that could be the whole show.
It could be the whole show. We could do a whole season on those, just those two things. So we're hoping to get some more episodes next year, but by all means, tune in, and you might see me on Ancient Aliens on the History Channel.
Oh, what I'll do is, you do have a little spot on YouTube where you're on Ancient Aliens. I'll throw a link to that as well. I'll embed that in the in the past guest area under your name. Also, right. You've done some. If people want to find some lectures that he's done, they're on the internet as well on YouTube.
Yeah, on my YouTube channel, right? Which you can get to through MikeBarra.com. So
everything goes through MikeBarra.com.
That's the idea.
Thank you for joining us. We're going to have to get back together and talk again. It seems like you got a lot of interesting projects coming up.
Yeah, I think that would be great, Scott. I'd really appreciate it.
Okay, and have a great day. And thanks. We'll talk to you guys next week. Bye-bye.